This is the Welcome to Fatherhood Podcast. I'm your host. My name is Kelly, and I'm here to remind you, however you're listening and wherever you're listening, that as dads, we're just like moms. Except we're dads. Ha ha! All right. I'm going to ask you to please introduce yourself.
Well, my name's Patrick Cummings. I recently wrote a book called The Family Business Balancing Act. And what I'm hoping to do is I'm hoping to help some fathers out there just become better dads. And we only know what we were raised by. Mm-hmm. And not that my dad was a bad dad, but, you know, we live in a different time today. And there's so many children, I think, who are missing the father figure in their life. Whether they're present or they're not present, that I think we need to kind of turn the tide and stop the focus so much on success as far as how much is in the checkbook versus success is what kind of family we raise. And yeah. So I'm excited to be here. Just thanks for having me.
No, thank you for coming on. So let's take it back a little bit to when you first became a father.
Yeah.
What was that experience like? What were some of the things that you felt like you were happening upon, things that perhaps you were surprised by in terms of, you know, struggles here? Oh, I didn't think it was going to be this way. Like, what was that initial entrance into fatherhood like for you?
Yeah. Wow. Well, the entrance into fatherhood was terrifying. Found out my wife was pregnant. I had just left the job and was starting a new one. And, you know, so obviously there was some terrifying thoughts in my mind because we had tried to have kids for a while and couldn't. And then all of a sudden we decided we're not going to try anymore and we're pregnant. But, you know, then it led into an emergency C-section. Mm-hmm. So here there's, you know, there's supposed to be this wonderful event of birth. And it was a situation where they said, scrub, you're going to the emergency or you're going in the surgery room right now with your wife. And, you know, so it wasn't what
do
I
mind,
expected.
Do you mind if we camp here for a second just to,
sure,
to get
sure
in the weeds of that a little bit? Is that okay?
Yeah, sure. But because I wasn't expecting that, right?
Yeah,
I mean,
well, that's the question I was going to ask, like how prepared. So in the months leading up to the delivery, mm-hmm, did you and your wife do parental classes? Did you guys do any of that stuff? And did any of that prepare you for this outcome in particular?
No. So we go through the Lamaze classes and you do the breathing and you do all the stuff and they try and prepare the man for, you know, oh my God, this head.
Yeah.
Like they try and prepare you for all that. And so we're in the labor process and it goes on and on and on. And we didn't know it at the time, but my son's head got stuck in the birth canal. And so they put the things on him to try and pull him out. And
did that vacuum thing?
Well, they did the vacuum thing and then they did these massive clamp on his head to try and pull it out. And they had a heart monitor screwed into the top of his skull. And you know, I'm thinking, this is not what I expected, right?
What?
This is not what I expected. So his heart rate was going off the chart. My wife was really struggling. And all of a sudden, he started to crash. And the nurse literally pushed him back in.
Oh, wow.
And said, we need to go to the emergency surgery now.
Holy
and
smokes.
They grabbed me. I was like, what is happening? Right? They take me over, scrub me in, put the surgical gown and everything on me, and they drag me into the operating room. And it was terrifying.
Mm-hmm.
It was terrifying because, you know, at that point, all the thoughts start going through your head. Am I going to lose my wife? Am I going to lose my baby? What's going on? I'm not prepared for this. Who do I talk to? And, you know, there was nobody there. It's like, ah. And, you know, fortunately they pull him out, but he wasn't breathing. And, you know, they get all that stuff cleaned off of this body and then he started crying, which, you know, I just started crying too, because
that was the best sound you've ever heard, I bet.
Yeah. And so, no, I wasn't prepared at all, you know, and I wasn't prepared then for, cause we didn't have parental leave, right? We didn't have paternity leave back then. And I was working for, company traveling and doing all that stuff. And I wasn't prepared for having to care for my wife as well as a newborn. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's just a challenge that you just got to get through. I mean, you just do what you got to do to get through it. And, so that's where we were at. And, the problem was, is my wife had gone through almost 24, 28 hours of labor up to the C-section. So if you schedule a C-section, you know, you're not exhausted at the time it's over.
Sure.
She was literally just spent. And so, no, I wasn't prepared at all. But thank God it all worked out fine.
Yeah.
Our daughter was born a little over three years later. Same thing. Mm. Like, we were asking beforehand, do we need to just schedule a C-section? And the doctor, no, we're going to do this natural and blah, blah, blah. And we go 30 hours.
Same
thing. But this time, at least we had experienced it before. And now there was the level of disappointment, hurt, anger with the doctor. Why did we do this? Why did we put my wife through and the baby through this? Right. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah,
I'm curious, disappointed in who or what?
We were disappointed in the medical process because she had had this emergency C-section before because the, you know, our son's head got stuck in the birth canal. And so we had told him all of that. It was a different medical provider. We were in a different facility, different town. Mm-hmm. And we told them that, and they said, you know, it should be okay. We'll think we'll be okay. Well, we go 30 hours.
Jeez.
And then our daughter starts to crash. My wife's just done. And we do emergency C-section again. And so, you know, that the disappointment was just, why did we have to go
through that again?
Through this. When we talked about it up front and, you know, after 12 hours, why didn't we do something versus 30 hours?
So here you are and your wife, and you are reliving this thing that you've lived before.
Yeah.
What kind of effect did that have on you? And what kind of effect did that have on how you saw yourself as a husband, as a man, as a father?
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, that's a tough question. I felt terrible for my wife. Because I couldn't take any of it.
It is the most hopeless, one of the most hopeless feelings.
Yeah, I couldn't take any of it away. The only thing I could do was to care for her. And we had gone through this before. And so, you know, this go around, her mom and my mom, we had kind of gone through this before. And on the first time, my mom wasn't present when the baby was born. And the second time, neither one of our parents were present, but we had a little bit of framework, right, to go from. Okay, this is where we're at. And finally, when you get through the frustration of why did we let it go this far, you get through that. And then, okay, this is what we got to do. And at that point in time, I was working for a different corporation, and they did give us some grace. They gave me some time to, you know, to be home to care for. Financially, we were in a different position, a better position.
Okay.
The second time was tough, but we had gone through it.
Yeah.
We knew we were going to make it. It's just make sure that my wife's healthy and the baby was healthy. My daughter was healthy.
Yeah. So now your children are how old?
23 and 26.
So you are way on the other side of these experiences.
Yep.
If you could, and I'm going to ask you to do this again towards the end of our conversation, but I think it's an important interjecting point right now with everything that you've shared, and thank you for sharing that. Now that you're on the other side of this horrific event times two.
Yeah.
If you could talk to a dad who is going to the hospital with his wife, his partner, his girlfriend, whatever the arrangement yeah. is, great. How would you advise this dad in terms of what he might face if it's anything at all similar to what you and your wife faced?
Wow. That's a really good question, because you don't want to put the fear in them that this could go bad.
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't want to tell somebody, hey, just be prepared. This could go bad. I think having the confidence in the medical staff that, you know, you guys are going to be taken care of. Now, people who are going to go do this at home, I don't know what we'd have done if we'd had a midwife, right?
Yeah.
I mean, I can't imagine. It probably wouldn't have worked out well at all. But, you know, but I think the biggest thing is I hope they have faith, right? I hope they have some faith, because the process of bringing a person or human being into the world is unbelievable. I mean, if you think about everything that has to go right.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's crazy. Yeah. So I would hope they would have some faith, you know, but also have confidence in the medical community. Be graceful to your wife. Right. And the other part of it is, in today's world, we didn't have social media back then. Right. Mm-hmm. Don't take your phone into the birthing room. Don't take any pictures of things that could come back later that are incredibly private. But it's also a time that cherish that time with your spouse.
Mm-hmm.
You don't have to, you know, every 15 minutes post what's going on, because I think you need that time of bonding with your spouse, with the new child, because it's an incredible time. It's an incredibly difficult time for the mom.
Mm-hmm.
But it's also an incredibly amazing time of bringing a person into the world. And, you know, I think the sad part today is that we're so glued to social media that we have to share every single thing that's happening.
Mm.
Share that later, but don't share the really intimate private stuff, right? And that's just coming off the top of my head, Kevin.
Yeah, yeah.
Now, before that, right, we have two gentlemen in my office that are having, one's having his third child, one's having his first.
Okay.
And, you know, it's fun listening to the conversation between the two of them because, you know, when I was having the first conversation with my business partner, Kyle, he's like, yeah, whatever, we got this. And pretty soon, you know, he's a puddle of goo because this experience, you can't emotionally prepare for what's going to go on, right?
No.
And so now he's sharing it and I'm listening to him sharing it with Josh, who's going to have their first child. And, you know, Josh is very naive. I love the kid, very naive to the world. And he's just like, he's going into this thing eyes wide open, but he's Mr. Procrastinator. Like this guy, he is Mr. Procrastinator. And so we were chatting in that parking lot last night and he says, oh, I'm pushing this stuff off. I'll do the baby room later. And blah, blah, blah. And I go, Josh, you need to realize, man, this baby's coming when this baby's coming.
Facts.
The doctor may tell you that it's October 5th.
Baby,
but on September 5th, on September 5th, you might be holding the baby and your wife's going, I told you,
yep.
You know, so don't create that stress. Try and prep for the stresses that are going to come, because it could come anytime. Your wife could be put on bed rest. She could have an emergency C-section at any time, you know, and I'm not saying that to scare him, but you gotta be prepared.
Yeah.
And you know, as much as you can, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, it's the, for me, is this thing of how much of it is not wanting to scare the person and how much of it is being realistic about what can also happen.
Sure.
Right? It's like there is a sense of, which everyone assumes, I think that's the basic assumption, that we all go into when we're, you know, at that phase, like baby is coming. I mean, I remember that day. It wasn't that long ago for me, just 2 years ago, but I still remember it as if it happened yesterday, you know, all the details and all of that stuff.
Oh, yeah.
And when baby said he was coming, he was coming.
Yeah.
And yeah.
Yeah, there's no pause button.
No. No,
there's no pause button.
No, no such thing whatsoever. But I've always been fascinated by what goes on in these prep classes for parents. My wife and I didn't get to go through it because COVID shut everything down.
Oh, sure.
So we didn't go through it. So I literally went into the hospital, the delivery room, and all of that stuff with zero information whatsoever in regards to what that class offers. Yeah. But I've been fascinated by, you know, how much of a more complete expectation would a class like that offer parents if we absolutely put the premium on, this is how we hope things will happen. This is what we're all cheering for. This is what we're hoping for. This is how it should happen. In the event that things go sideways and you can't really predict in which way things could go sideways, but at least to put it on the table as something that we're not avoiding and something that is as real as what we're hoping for, I think there's something lacking there in that it doesn't seem like these prep classes necessarily offer enough of that. I recall hearing a podcast where this woman was talking about going through one of those birthing classes or reading a book. And it was like at the end of the book, maybe the last phrase of the book that was like, oh, by the way, things could go south. Thank you for reading the book. You know what I mean?
So yeah.
I think there's something there. I think there's something that's lacking, something that sets a false expectation, if you will, because your story, my story, so many other stories, there were moments there where we weren't sure if our babies were going to make it, if our wives were going to make it. In my experience, I got to a point where I was thinking, am I going to leave this hospital without a wife and a child?
Right.
And that was just a terrifying thought.
Right. And, you know, our brain is not prepared for that.
Mm-mm.
We have this part of our brain, they call it the lizard part of your brain or the limbic part of your brain. That's the fight or the flight portion, and that kicks in, and having rational thought at that point in time can be difficult. And so I think at least if in these classes or somebody can say, hey, in the event, I'm not trying to be a Debbie Downer here, but in the event something goes south, you got to have confidence in the medical team. You know, and have faith, because you know, we can't control it. We, as guys, we want to answer the, you know, whatever the problem is, hey, we got a solution, right? Yeah. That's just men.
That's just how we're wired.
And we want to be able to control it. You can't control any of that, like none of it. And, you know, there's going to be a point in a lot of these situations, and you might laugh here, but there's a point in that birthing process, that labor process where your life's, you know, you're lovey-dovey and all this is great. And pretty soon your partner may reach up and grab you by the throat to say, you're the SOB who did this to me, right? And all of a sudden you go from happy and loving to, I'm going to rip your throat out because you did this to me. And I don't recall in the class them telling you that.
Yeah.
It's like all of a sudden, it's like, you know, you're loving on each other and then wham.
That's how she draws.
You're laughing. I mean, you're laughing. So you probably experienced what I'm talking about. But, you know, after the second one, we'll laugh here for a second. But after our second emergency C-section, my wife's a veterinarian, right? She says, you're going to the doctor. So this doesn't happen again, or I'm taking care of it.
Yeah.
And, you know, you don't want a veterinarian doing that. But
no.
all joking aside, you have to, you go into this you have to go into this with a degree of compassion for your spouse, significant other, that it's an amazing experience.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And I pray that for everybody going through it, that it goes well, but it's an amazing experience. And I can't even imagine for a woman to get to that point and have carried a baby for 9 months and their thought process of potentially losing that child at that point. Mm-hmm. It's gotta be, I mean, how do you prepare for that?
Yeah.
You know, and so the other thing after the baby's born is, man, you better sleep when you can sleep.
100%.
And, you know, baby's taking a nap. You better be taking a nap, and you better give your wife the chance, especially if they go through a C-section, because not only are they recovering from carrying this baby for 9 months or however long, but now they're trying to recover from a major surgery. Right. Yep. And, you know, you best not have an expectation that that person's going to be making you dinner and cleaning the house. And, you know, you better not, because it's not going to go well.
It's one of those moments where every single gender role expectation, all of that just comes crashing into your reality, and you realize none of this crap really matters. Like, we just got to wade through this period and do what is necessary to be done so that we can get to the other side.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly.
Yeah. No, I appreciate you allowing me to spend some time there. It's one of those things where you're right. There is no way to prepare someone emotionally for the toll that takes, the trauma that someone internalizes as a result of all of this. And what I find myself telling some of my buddies and even my cousin who recently had a baby while they were in that process was, trust your instinct, because you also have instinct as a father. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Be your wife's eyes, ears, mouthpiece if she's not able to talk because of pain, epidural, whatever other serum they put in her.
Right.
No question is a stupid question.
Right.
Ask about absolutely everything. If something just doesn't seem right, doesn't feel right, I mean, I don't care if you have to be the annoying guy, but make sure that just as you walked into the hospital, your wife and your child in the womb, you walk out of that hospital, your wife in hand, your baby in a car seat. That's the goal. However that baby comes out, vaginal, C-section, it doesn't matter. Healthy mom, healthy baby, happy dad, we're good to go.
You know, I would add something there, Kelly, is try and pretty tough to keep your emotion in check. Mm-hmm. But if things get tense, if you can be as calm as possible, that is going to help your spouse. Mm-hmm. Because if your level of angst, and I mean, when stuff's going south, one's going to look at you and go, hey, Kelly, calm down.
Yeah, no.
That doesn't work. Then you just get flared up. But I mean, if you can think about that, and you know, I don't know, it's an amazing process.
Yeah, so 100%.
I can, you know, I'm not ready for grandkids. I don't feel like I'm old enough to have grandkids, but I can't wait.
Yeah.
You know, so.
So let's get into the book that you wrote.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And tell me a little background history. Why did you feel it necessary for you to write this book? What were some of the driving forces that led you to pen these words in this book?
Yeah. So, you know, it goes all the way back to as early as I can remember as a child. My dad left when I was five, and he was still part of my life. It's not like he left and never was never involved again, but my dad left when I was five, and I was raised by a single mom, and my brother moved to be with my dad when I was nine. And, you know, growing up without a father figure in my life, you know, except for every other weekend, was a challenge. And at the time I didn't know. And I do remember looking back to baseball games or, sporting events or different things, looking to see where my dad was. And sometimes he was there and sometimes he wasn't. And it wasn't the times that I wasn't disappointed in the times when he would sit down with me and say, "Hey, look, I really want to be there, but I can't." It was the times that he said he was going to be there and he wasn't.
Yeah.
So I think it goes all the way back to that. And, you know, then, you know, leading up to when we did have kids, my dad was a workaholic. His dad was a workaholic. His dad worked in the logging camps and in the mills 16 hours a day, 6 days a week, coming out of the Depression. I mean, it was, you had to provide for your family. That was life back then. And then my dad comes out of that, right? And everything was about awards and performance. And he had gotten a full ride scholarship to run track and at Eastern Washington University, and that paid for his education, but it was all about performance. Mm-hmm. And then he became a coach and athletic director. And again, it's all about performance. Well, he taught my brother and I, it was all about performance. And there were times when I felt like I didn't measure up because I wasn't the greatest athlete. Right? Mm-hmm. I wasn't tall enough to be, you know, Spud Webb's 5'6", can dunk the basketball. I'm 5'8". I can't touch the rim. I wasn't going to be a basketball player. You know, I wasn't great at that. I wasn't big enough to excel on a football team, although I certainly tried. Mm-hmm. But, you know, so I just felt at times that I just didn't measure up to that. And so then when I have kids, I had been working and providing and making as much money as I could, because that was the American dream. Mm-hmm. It's what you're told to do. You're going to go get this job. It's all about your level of where you are in this corporation and how much money you're making. And then you throw a kid into the mix, and now your company is expecting that level of performance. They're expecting that level of effort. And, you know, early on, I wasn't realizing that I wasn't taking the time for my kids. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I was working for a corporation. In the book, I talk about the fact that, you know, when my son turned 4 years old, I realized that one entire year of his life, I was looking through the windshield of my vehicle, traveling my sales territory, literally driving. I drove 60,000 miles a year in the sales territory. And I said, I don't want to do this anymore. I don't want the neighbor raising my kid. I don't want this life.
Yeah.
And that's when I changed to the financial industry. And, you know, so going through all that process and then starting from scratch and trying to figure out, how do I balance? My wife's a veterinarian. She might be on call. I got to get the kids to school. How do you balance that? And my kids were my why. My family was the reason why I was doing what I was doing. You know, so you go through that process, went through some really challenging time with my kids. I write about that in the book. Everybody does, right? Mm-hmm. There's challenging times. They turn teenagers, just so if you don't know this, when your kid turns a teenager, it's like, where did my daughter go and who are you? But, you know, if no one prepares you, you need to start preparing for that. But so as that's occurring and I'm finding myself in arguments with my supervisor or the representative for the company that I was working with, about the time I wanted to take for my family, because I got into the business to be able to manage my time. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, fast forward some more years and I lost my dad. And I lost my dad. It'll be 3 years in October. And I see the damage that was done between my dad and my brother, and that never got healed. And my brother's older than I am. I was able to heal that relationship with my dad through forgiveness. We both forgave each other. My dad resented the fact of what he had done his whole life. And so the book started coming out before I ever thought about writing a book.
Yeah.
And these stories that I tell, these stories that are in the book, are oftentimes stories or analogies that I use when I'm coaching some young people coming into business. Of the pitfalls that I got into, the mistakes that I made, the mistakes I see other people make, mm-hmm. and how you can be successful and yet at the same time be successful in business and at the same time be a good husband, spouse, partner, parent. And so I was telling these stories. Somebody actually said to me, why don't you write this stuff down? Like, why don't you write this down? Because Pat, you only have so much time. And I was going, working with a company called Strategic Coach. Uh-huh. It's an executive coaching program. And lo and behold, one of the sessions was about writing our story, that everybody has a valuable story to tell. And so on the airplane flying home from California, I wrote out this rough draft agenda outline. And for a couple of weeks, I kind of massaged that. And then I just reached out to Scribe and said, hey, I wonder if I have a story. Mm-hmm. And that's really kind of how the process began. And then through the process, Kelly, I found there was closure with my dad, his passing. There was some healing that happened there. Mm-hmm. There's some healing, more healing between my kids and I. Mm-hmm. My spouse is really freaked out about the book. I shouldn't say really freaked out, but she read the first three chapters and put it down. And she said, you're too transparent. You're too authentic. Wow. I'm not comfortable with this. You know, my wife's very private, introverted. And I told her, I said, as a man, we need to be more authentic. We need to be more vulnerable. Mm-hmm. We can't keep it all inside. And so if I can write this story and I can save a kid's life or I can save a marriage, mm-hmm. That's what I want to do. And so, you know, that's kind of the genesis of where the book came from. And I have no idea where this is going. I'm having a lot of fun.
Yeah.
And I have people tell me, did you write the book specifically for me? Because this one chapter was specific to me, and so I think there's some satisfaction from that. But really, I wrote the book to get my story out there. Maybe it was selfish for the healing. You know, I didn't know that was going to happen because it was very emotional. There were sections of the book. If you read the book, there's sections of the book that, you know, I shed some tears in those chapters. But at the end of it, you know, one of my best friends read the book and he just gave me a big hug, tears in his eyes. It makes me have tears in my eyes right now, but tears in his eyes that he just said, Pat, thank you for that. So that's how the book started.
Yeah.
Probably more than you wanted to hear.
No, everything I wanted to hear. I like the fact that, because I was going to ask you, did you feel like this was a cathartic process for you? And you alluded to that. Absolutely. There was something there. And, you know, now we live in a generation where, or in a day and age where a lot more of this sharing of one's story is encouraged, because what we've come to realize as a race is that really the things that we were upholding as differences are in fact what makes us the same. And so there is a common thread that I feel like, you know, this holistic version of humanity is embracing, which is your story within your context with those particular details are entirely yours, but they're also all of us.
Right.
And we can all identify, if not with everything, with some core aspect of what it means to be a child who wants to have a relationship with his father. And for whatever reason, that father is not there. Or for some people, it might be a mother. It might be a grandmother. It might be somebody of importance.
Sure.
Who is not there, the implications of that, how that sort of shifts and taints how this child sees him or herself growing up. And, you know, we could talk about all sorts of implications, but then getting to, you know, running through that arc and saying, yeah, and at the end of it, this is the product. Like, this thing did not break me. This thing, it hurt me in a lot of ways. It even prevented me from achieving, who knows, maybe a greater potential, but it's undeniable that it also fueled so much of who I am now, my outlook, and all of that jazz.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
I think that's beautiful. I think that's beautiful.
Well, and something you said there, you know, a father figure that's either present or not present. And I wanted to find that even further, because driving here this morning, you know, I see all these people on the phone and life's so busy and they're speeding to get around you. And mm-hmm. there's kids in the backseat, and the kids in the backseat are watching something on the iPad.
Yeah.
And the parent is on the phone.
Yeah.
Are we even present when we are there?
Well, okay. I'm glad that you're saying that. So I feel like you're anticipating the questions I'm about to ask you, which is amazing. Let's define what, at least in this conversation, we think we mean by being present.
Sure.
So,
well, yeah. Go ahead. Go ahead. No, go ahead.
What is being present for you?
Okay. So, This is amazing. You asked me this question because I was out for a long walk yesterday morning, and on that walk, I was thinking through a conversation I'd had, and what's come out of this is I started a company called Progress Not Perfection, and why? Mm-hmm. Because we can't do this perfectly, right? So how do you go from maybe you're living a life that's just full octane all the time, and you're busy, and you're telling me that I need to make these changes to be more present as a father. Mm-hmm. And let's just say that you're the average family in America that doesn't sit down and have dinner together or doesn't sit and have breakfast together, but maybe once a week. And, okay. and this is very common, right?
Yeah. Yep.
So maybe that's you. Maybe that's the listener right now, that you're not having a meal together. My wife and I go out every week. Every week we go out on a date. Thursdays are the date days. And if that doesn't work, then it gets moved. Like tomorrow she got called into work already, so we got to move our date, but we go out on a date and I intentionally do not take my phone.
Mm-hmm.
Right? How many times you go to a restaurant or you go out and the entire family is sitting on their device?
Yeah.
We had our 32nd anniversary last week, and we went out to a movie and went out to dinner, and there are people in the movie theater, they're on their phones, and there's people at dinner, this family's together at dinner. Here they are in supposedly a special setting, and every single one of them has a device and there's no conversation. Mm. What if, mm-hmm. Kelly, what if that's you? What if you take one night and you say, okay, dinner on Sunday is for the family,
mm-hmm.
and no phones are allowed at the table. No phones are allowed to even be within earshot.
Mm-hmm.
And what we're going to do is we're going to go around the table and everybody's going to give a positive focus of something that happened to them this last week. And let's just have that conversation. So maybe it's this little piece of progress, right? That, mm-hmm. that if it's such a monumental change, you can't eat the elephant in one bite. You got to do it one bite at a time. Maybe it's that. Maybe it's, you know, I have friends that, hey, if my kids are going to be doing stuff with me, we're going to be doing what I want to do, and they're going to tag along.
Mm-hmm.
That was me with my dad. If I wanted to hang out with my dad, I went to work mm-hmm. with my dad.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe it's, hey, what is my kid really passionate about? And let's spend a Saturday or a Sunday or a Wednesday or doing just what they want to do.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right. I mean, I talk about in the book going to horse shows, you know, and I liken it to watching paint dry because it was just agony of an all day event. And my daughter rode for 15 minutes. But if you're at that event, you're not sitting in the stands with your laptop computer while they're doing their show. Maybe it's actually being present in that moment.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
My son loved wheels, anything with wheels and an engine. And so mm-hmm. we would buy motors that were blown or, you know, going to scrap, and we'd tear them apart and rebuild them. And, you know, you can go to a junkyard and pull an engine, or you can go to some place and get something that's not working, pull it apart, see how it works. What mm-hmm. are the components? Hey, can we put this thing back together and make it run? Mm-hmm. And I am not a good mechanic. Like, I have a degree in economics, right? But the time that we spent together doing those things and researching, I think those are the times that begin to glue you. And then have your child come along and experience what it is that is your passion. Mm-hmm. But don't make it all about that, right? So many times I see people that their kid has to fully embrace and be in their passion all the time. And our mm-hmm. kids aren't going to be passionate about what we are all the time.
Yeah.
My daughter and my son are my best friends. My daughter loves hunting more, I think, than my son does, because I introduced her to that, but I introduced her in such a way that, you know, the weather was nice. I bought her the decent clothes so she wasn't miserable. And mm-hmm. but participating, Kelly, it's are you participating? And, you know, when my kids were young, my daughter played youth volleyball, and I would see parents show up and the dad would have a laptop computer and they're typing on the laptop computer during the game, or they just weren't present.
Yeah.
And so I think turning other things off, talking to your kids about, you know, how many dads know what their kid's favorite color is. So I think it goes back to something that's very, very basic. Everybody will go, yeah, that's not news to me, but, you know, try having dinner once or twice or three times a week with no device, right? No phones allowed.
Yeah.
And see how that works, because we all can get sucked into it.
Yeah. And if it's not dinner, create some time where the family can be in each other's presence without any interference.
Yeah.
And just have a conversation about something.
Yeah.
And yeah, I think the word that kept bouncing around in my mind as you were talking is quid pro quo. It's a sense of you give and they give, right?
Yep.
I invest, my child invest. I think the careful and the wisdom of that comes in as the parent. The responsibility is mostly on me, should be mostly on me, to really invest in the thing that makes my child light up.
Yep.
And in return, when they see that, hopefully they would return the favor. But I don't think that there is a greater joy than for me to see. So currently my son is 2 years old and he loves trucks. He is into trucks. He has a particular affinity to wheels. So anything that's not a car, anything from a pickup on up, he is absolutely enamored with. So on our drive in the morning to take him to my in-laws house, mm-hmm. we live right by a busy street. Or right off a busy street. So we turn on this busy street called Roosevelt Boulevard. And there are big rigs, concrete mixers, school buses, delivery trucks. I mean, you name it, it goes through. We don't live too far from a fire department. And so sometimes we see the fire trucks and the ambulance and police cars and the whole nine. So he's in the back seat, and now because he's two, he's front facing. And oh my word, Daddy, you see the school bus? Daddy, you see the concrete mixer? Daddy, you see this? And at first for me, it was like, yeah, bro, I've seen these things before. But just to see how much he lights up. And I came to that conclusion because when he would be so excited and pointing these things out that to him are just absolutely exciting, even if he sees six of them in a row, to me is like, whatever. The moment that I started responding to him as, yes, I see it. I would see his face and he would start to turn off.
Right.
And I said, I can't do that. I can't do that to him. He's excited. So I have to match his excitement. So now when we're driving, Daddy, you see the school bus? And I'm like, oh my God, look at the school bus. And he just lights up. And it's just this amazing feeling that I don't care about the school bus. I care about my son who is so excited about spotting a school bus. And so now I'm proud that he makes the association. That's a school bus that has wheels. Every car has wheels. And I, Juki, every car has wheels. But he's like, you see the wheels? Yeah, buddy, I see the wheels. Dad, did you see the wheels? Yeah, buddy, I saw the wheels. And we're talking about wheels for like 5 minutes.
Well, it won't be long, Kelly, and you'll be saying, what kind of engine is in that school bus? What kind of engine do you think they have in that cement mixer? And he's going to be like,
yeah, I mean, it's just to see the child light up in that way, I think there's no greater satisfaction. There's no greater joy than that. And I think that sends a very strong message to them. Their interests matter.
Their interests matter.
Their excitement matters. No doubt. Their thoughts matter. They matter. So, yeah, 100% behind what you just said.
Thing about it is what you're talking about is something called unique ability. And there's a book, I don't want to go try and find it right now, but there's a book called Unique Ability 2.0. And Kelly, what it talks about is we're all hardwired in a certain way of something that we're excellent at. We really enjoy it. We're, you know, continuous learning, but we're passionate. Mm-hmm. And if you have that, that is your unique ability. And you want to find somebody who is just, their life is a joy, is somebody who is working in that unique ability the majority of the time. It's like nirvana. When I'm sitting with a prospective client and I'm interviewing them and I'm really trying to find out what it is about their future that they want to do, and I can help them begin to see that it can happen. That is where I'm just passionate, right? I hate making sales calls. I just can't stand it. But I love standing in front of a group of young individuals talking about what is their why and how can they pursue that why. And And you know, what is it going to be? I had this phone call yesterday about how can we get these young people in the business, you know, 10 to 12% survive 5 years, survive in the business. I'm sorry. We don't kill them off. but how can we get that number to be a better sticky number? And if somebody doesn't have a strong enough why and grit, they're not going to make it, right? My son, hearing deficit, we didn't find out until he was in ninth grade and all the stuff that went into that, and thought he was a failure in school, goes on to a specialty school in Ohio for high performance automotive, and he's on the dean's list, and he just signed as a mechanic with Arrow McLaren. Like, he's at the top of the chart in the Indy world. Why? Because of his passion.
Yeah.
What you're talking about. Because of his passion and because of his work ethic.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, my daughter wants to be a veterinarian. She wants to be an orthopedic surgeon, and her passion. And, you know, I'm not going to go to her like you're talking about. I'm not going to go to her and go, why on earth would you want to put bones back together in a dog?
Yeah. Yeah.
It's like, oh my God, you could be the best surgeon. Yeah. And not only that, how many female surgeons in that world do you see? Mm. Next mm-hmm. to none. Mm-hmm. Like, sweetheart, you can be like, wah.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
so, and so supporting what your kid's passion is, what an awesome thing.
Yeah.
Right. 100%. I mean, can you imagine if you're a mathematician or you're a mechanic or you're a, you know, whatever you are, and your kid's Beethoven, and you say, what are you playing that song for? That's, you know, no one's written that song. You're just making that up. Really? Well, yeah. You know what I'm saying? It's so I think that passion is, it's so important. But again, going back to what you said earlier, what you asked earlier, if you're not involved in helping cultivate that, who's going to do it?
Yeah.
Because you certainly don't want the group of teenagers down the road cultivating something, right? Mm. I want to cultivate who my kids become mm-hmm. and at least be part of it.
Yeah.
And so, so it's just so important. And if they love school buses and cement mixers, I have a good friend who his son, similar thing, but his is tractors.
Oh yeah.
We live in an agricultural area, you know, and he sees a tractor and he's at the point, he's 9 years old and he knows what kind of engine's in it. He knows how much horsepower it has. It knows, you know, it's like, holy cow, I had no idea. So it's pretty awesome.
Yeah, that's pretty cool.
Pretty awesome.
Our time is almost coming to an end, but I do want to ask you to speak to the balance, this work-life balance mm-hmm. through the lens of sacrifice.
Mm-hmm.
How does one achieve this balance that is so fleeting for so many people?
Yeah.
With this concept of I have to sacrifice something in order to achieve whatever goal that this person is trying to strive when it comes to family goals, but also business career goals. So can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah. So if you're going to be successful in anything, you got to be able to manage your calendar, have somebody manage your calendar, right? And so just like for you, you got to schedule stuff. It's got to fit. And so you can get from one thing to another. And I would say number one, make sure you're scheduling time on that time system. Make sure you're scheduling time for your family. Because if you don't, work will expand to eat up available time. So, you know, that quote, work will expand to eat up available time, is going to happen. And so if you don't have it written down, you know, Thursdays, noon, Brooke, lunch, something's going to happen. It's going to fill it up. The other thing to recognize, Kelly, is everybody is unique in the amount of how much emotional energy they have.
Mm-hmm.
Some people don't have a lot. Some people have an amazing amount, but you only have a specific amount.
Yes.
You cannot drink a cup of coffee and get more emotional energy, right? There's no energy drink that does it. And so I think if somebody early on can recognize that this is how much emotional energy I have, and if I expend every bit of it every mm-hmm. day at work, I got nothing left for my family. You need to protect some of that mm-hmm. and you need to protect it for yourself, right? Because you'll have an emotional breakdown. You need to protect some of it for your spouse because they may come home, or your partner, they may come home and just had a horrible day. And if you're done, how much support are you going to be, right? So you got to reserve some of that emotional support. But then going back to the business, there's an analogy, and I should look up who did this, but there's a gentleman who sat in front of a class and he had a big beaker, a big pitcher, and he put these big rocks into this glass container. And he said, is the jar full? And the class said, yeah. So he took some gravel and he poured in over the top of these big rocks. And he said, now is the glass full? I said, yeah. And he took some real fine sand and he put it in there and he shook it. Now is the glass full? And the class goes, yeah, of course it's full. You can't put anything more in there. He took water and he poured over the top of it until water poured out. And he says, now the glass is full. And he pulled out another one and he took and he put in the sand and then he filled it with water. And he says, is the thing full? And the class didn't know what to say. And they were like, well, yeah, it kind of seems full. So he went to start putting the rocks in and he couldn't fit the rocks. And the point is, the rocks are the most important thing first. And so if you're going to work, if you're going to business, you have to write down, what are the three or five things that have to get done today before anything else? And you have to do that first, because if you don't, you're playing in the sand. And if you expend your energy and your time playing in the sand, you're never going to move the big rocks. Mm-hmm. And so for me, if I have to make five presentations a day, or if I have to do, you know, certain things, those need to get done first, so that emotionally at the end of the day, there's success in completing those, right?
Yeah.
But if you put those to the end of the day and now you got to rush, how much emotional energy are you going to have left? So I would say prioritize what needs to get done and do those things first, because the rest of the day could blow up. And if you can start doing that, if you can schedule time in for your family, if you can schedule in that, you know, I only have this much emotional energy, or if you know you're getting close to it, it's okay to cancel something, right?
Yeah.
I had a meeting that just ruined my entire day because of the way I was treated in this meeting. And I called my team and I said, cancel the rest of my day, I'm done. And there were important meetings later that day, but I was not going to be on my game. I was not going to be the best version of me based on what had happened. Now I can control that because I'm a business owner, right?
Yeah.
If you're an employee, you can't, but I would say move the rocks, put your family in there into your time system, because if you don't, work's going to expand, fill it up. So I hope that was an answer to your question.
In the last couple of minutes that we have left, I would like to invite you to put yourself in the place of a young dad who is ambitious, who is good-hearted. He wants the best for his family.
Mm-hmm.
But like you and I, checkered history or lack thereof with his father. He wants to change the narrative in his own fatherhood journey. He has goals, but now he feels torn on how to even go about doing all of these things. What would you begin to say to that young man, to that young father, that could help him, not necessarily give advice to him, but be sort of an anchor to help him navigate how turbulent these waters are?
Well, the first thing I would tell him is to realize that you're not going to get it perfect.
Amen.
No one's going to get it perfect. So number one, you're not going to be perfect. But number two, if they can envision, what do I want my kids to think of me when I'm gone? Or what do I want them to be like when they're adults and teaching their kids? Because I think one of the things, Kelly, today is that our world has become so material that people strive for greatness financially, or they strive for greatness so they can have stuff to show that they're successful. And that's a bad narrative. And I think if somebody's very successful financially and they make life about that to their kids, they're setting their kids up for failure. Mm. And what I mean by that is, let's say that, you know, my kids are spoiled, but we taught them really good work ethic. Thank goodness we taught them good work ethic. But let's say that everything to them was free and easy because of my wife's, you know, being a veterinarian and myself having a successful business, and we didn't go without anything. Mm-hmm. Now you're raising them up and they're going to go out into society. And let's say that they marry somebody or get in a relationship with somebody that is absolutely passionate about being a photographer. They're a phenomenal photographer, or they're a phenomenal custodian. They're a phenomenal mechanic on school buses or whatever, but that profession doesn't put them in a financial position where life is really easy financially.
Yeah.
But they're very, very happy, right? They're passionate about what they do.
Yeah.
You're sending that child into a situation where they have an expectation because of what their parents did. Mm-hmm. And so what I would say is, for a young professional, if you can, you know, sitting inside the pickup, sitting inside that fancy car, they can't see the outside. They don't care what it looks like, right? They don't care. They don't care what kind of wheels are on the car, right?
Nope.
Because they can't see them. But if that's what you're driving for, I have to work harder so that I can buy this fancy vehicle, or I have to work harder so that I can put these wheels on the car, I think that teaches our kids the wrong thing. And unfortunately, that's what society is doing. And so, you know, again, number one, it's progress, not perfection. You're not going to get a perfect.
Yeah.
And I think if you're doing what you talked about in taking an interest in that child's passion, right, you're spending time with them, that's what becomes the most important as far as being a father. And I think people need to ask themselves the question, why do I want to be a father? Mm-hmm. It's a tough question.
That's a tough question.
Do I want to be a father just to be a father? And I'm going to bring this human being into existence, and I'm going to work my butt off, and I'm going to make all this money so that they have a better life than I had when I was growing up because my mom was a single school teacher, you know, single mom school teacher. And why do you want to be a dad? Because if your job becomes more important than your family, it just doesn't work well. And so I think, you know, taking each day as it comes, planning for it, right? Do the best you can do. And tomorrow is the first day of the rest of your life. Make tomorrow a better version of the day that you want than today. Life comes at you. That emergency C-section wasn't planned, right? So tomorrow, I don't know what's coming. But you know, just make a little bit of progress every single day and be a better father, be the person that you really want to be. And there's two books that I've read. Curtis Estes wrote a book called Life by Design. Mm-hmm. What is the life you want? And design that and work towards it. Mm-hmm. And then, Jeff Reeder, R-E-E-T-E-R, wrote a book called, Do Life Differently. Just because your life was this way, or just because your parents lived a life this way, doesn't mean you have to.
Yeah.
And not to say that our parents were bad, right? But maybe it's a different direction.
Different direction. Yeah. Yeah.
And be passionate about what you do, because, you know, life on earth is pretty short.
You can say that again. Where can people find your book, and how can they support through the purchase of the book?
Yeah. So the book, The Family Business Balancing Act, is on Amazon. There's a Kindle version. There's paperback. There's a hardback version. They can look up the website. PNP stands for Progress, Not Perfection, strategies.com.
Okay.
So they can go there. There's a link to Amazon. I'd love for people to read my book. You know, and I think if people read the book and listen to or accept the story.
Yeah.
There will be lives saved. There will be marriages saved. I really, truly believe that.
Okay. Yeah. I will make sure to include a link of that on the show notes, and also list the book under my website, the resources tab, for people to be able to find it there as well. Patrick, thank you so much for this hour of your time that you've shared with me, contributing to this platform, sharing your story and your experiences. Can't thank you enough. So just wishing you more success in your business as a family, and when it's time for you to put on that grandpa hat in that regard as well.
Yeah, well, thanks, Kelly, and welcome to fatherhood. You know, it's been a pleasure to meet you. You know, the interview that we did a while back, and then today, it's been my honor to be on your show. So I thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much.